has expectations of you, you have expectations of society. Okay? And it could be that the case of Jacob says that it is so. But however, there is one question, there is one difference between the case of Jacob and the case of where a person is studying poetry, where he would cheat there to... Where he's changing, where he's compensating for society. There are two types of compensating for society. Okay? One type of compensation for society is like... is the difference between, let's say, affirmative action or where I cheat to counteract an injustice where the society, let's say, for instance, with advocating sports. Why? Because I am cheating there only for myself, because the society is cheating me. I'm cheating to compensate that I should be successful, so they should take away what I deserve. While Yaakov, there was no benefit to him in the blessings. The blessings was there as a benefit to all of Klal Yisrael as a system of justice. So it's if you're doing something to compensate for justice, but for justice itself, maybe in that case you would be allowed to cheat. But where you're compensating for an injustice, so that you should benefit yourself, whether in that case you have the right to cheat at that point, at because of this distinction, I am not sure whether it would be included, and therefore the only way to really test out that at this point, the way I see it, is through checking out the halacha, how the halacha formulates the idea of cheating. That would be two areas. It's either lying or Geneva Stas, where I say something to you that I really don't mean, but I'm making you think that you owe me something when I really don't owe it to you. You see? So the thing is that those are the two areas that you have to check out, whether that type of cheating, where it's for your benefit, for your personal benefit to compensate for a defect in the laws of the society. There are three areas which the Torah says that you're allowed to lie. Okay? One is for shalom bayis, peace in the house. Okay? You could avoid an argument and a fight by lying, so then it's better to lie. Okay? Two is, it's a matter of life and death. And three is, if let's say I finish all of Talmud, and somebody asked me a question, did you finish all of Talmud? So I should lie and say, no, I finished parts of Talmud, but I didn't finish all of it. Okay? Now the question is, why are these areas permissible to lie, or to put it in our framework, you're really cheating. You're really telling him something that is really not true. Okay? That is the question. Insofar as life and death is concerned, we see that in halacha, many times you're allowed to, in other words, you're not allowed to drive on Shabbos. It's a matter of life and death, you are allowed. So we see that life has precedence over a lot of things, and therefore when it's a matter of life and death, you're allowed to lie, and then you have to deal with the emotion. Because you cannot perfect yourself if you're dead. You can only perfect yourself while you're alive, so you need that situation to perfect yourself, so we allow a leniency, even though it will cause a certain imperfection, but I'm going to have to deal with that imperfection to live. However, with peace in the house, you have to understand that when two people are operating together, there's a certain amount, after a while, there is one emotion against the other that comes up in a family. And therefore, sometimes to have peace in the house, I have to give up on one of my emotions to be able that piece in the house. Let's say my wife wants something that I feel I don't want. So I'll give up on my emotion just to avoid a fight. Okay? So therefore, Shalom Bayis itself is helping me to perfect my soul, not to give in to a certain emotion because of peace. Okay? And peace is a value that we have, that it's a good value. Now the question is, there are two parts that could affect my soul. There's lying and there's peace. Okay? In other words, there's peace in the house, but to have peace I'm going to have to lie. Okay? So either I argue, which is harmful to the soul, or I lie. There's one or two choices. I can only do one or the other. You see? Our sages hold that cheating is a less of a problem. It is a problem, but it's a less of a problem than the problem of dealing with Shalom Bayis. Peace in the house is a value that, even though to keep that value you have to harm your soul, that becomes more important and it's a harder thing where I'm in relationship to another person. I have to give up my personal self and even my value system. I have to cheat. I have to, a certain thing for peace, that in itself I have to deal with. So that is they hold that that's a greater loss to give up Shalom Bayis, peace in the house, than to give up cheating. And therefore you should cheat and not give up peace in the house. In the second case, by lying about the Talmud, how much you've coveted and learned in Talmud, there when you say that I learned all of Talmud, that could bring out your ego. And the worst thing is the ego, how it affects your thinking process without even noticing that it affects how you make a decision. Cheating is definitely an easier situation to deal with than the ego. Okay? And that over-evaluation of the self. You understand that over-evaluation of the self is a catastrophe insofar as your decision-making process. And so therefore the Torah holds that you should lie, even though that's a harm and it's something you're going to have to protect yourself to deal with it. That is a less of a harm than telling the truth about how much you are, how good you are, how great you are, because overestimation of the self is a catastrophe. And the question is there is a case where if you're at a wedding and the bride is not pretty, you're allowed to lie for the, you're allowed to say how beautiful the bride is. Okay? Now the thing is, in a marriage, what happens is there's a saying, marry in haste, repent at leisure. Okay? Now what does it mean, marry in haste? Marry in haste means that when you fall in love, the emotion takes over and I don't investigate the mistakes of the past. Right? So therefore by a spouse, afterwards the person starts seeing the faults of the spouse, and it takes away from the relationship of the marriage. Okay? And that's going to cause a breakdown in the peace of the house. Now, a lot of people are affected by how society looks at things. So to compensate, to help out in a marriage, you're allowed to lie. You're allowed to lie to have peace in the house. It's the same, like we said before, it's the same category of peace in the house, but it's in somebody else's house. You're allowed to lie to help another group out and to say, look how great your spouse is. But it should be in an area that you're not going to get caught, because if you get caught, then it's not going to help, and then they won't trust you anymore when you say something. But you should, but wherever possible, it is it is correct to lie to help another house, that they should avoid an argument, you're allowed to lie in that type of situation. There is another case, if you have a host that really went out of their way to be gracious and to be nice, or somebody did you a very big favor, so it's all right to lie and say, and not, or avoid telling the truth. I mean, you shouldn't put the guy down, but I mean, not to go too far. See, yeah, it was a good host, like, but not to overplay the host, or the kindness that somebody did to you. You should not tell him the full amount of what the kindness he did. The reason for that is because it is a harm to the person that did you the favor. Because other people will start running to that guy and asking him for a favor, and you're destroying the guy. The guy will stop doing favors. Because there's a certain quantity, and if you build up the guy, everybody's going to go to that person, and therefore you're going to stop the guy from doing kindness in the future, and you don't have the right to harm this person. So it's not lie. You shouldn't lie about it, but don't go the full amount. Say, yeah, he's a good host, but don't add, you know, yeah, he's a good host, I enjoyed my son, was very nice. But, like, make it normal. But do not say, boy, he did this for me, or did that for me, or somebody lends you money, and this guy lent me $1,000, he's unbelievably great. That's wrong, because then other people are going to come to that loan. Okay? It's not fair to the person that gave you the loan. So it's not a matter of lying, it's just not a matter of not talking about it and keeping it a truth at a lower level. Okay? That's the case. But even in that case, I think the sages say that you're allowed to lie. I think so. Even if it comes down to if somebody asks you, then you should lie so that you should not harm the person that did you a favor. The conclusion that we have is that if it's to benefit society, that's definitely allowed. If you are cheating to compensate for the weakness of society to benefit yourself, at this point, we do not know if that is permissible. That needs further investigation.
I'd like to discuss the responsibility of the prophets and of the human and of, you know, regular people, and the differences between the responsibilities. Okay? Alright, so let's go for it. The first area that I'd like to take is in Exodus chapter 3, verse 12. And God says in the verse, I will be with you. And Rashi, in middle of Rashi, he says, and this is the vision that you saw in the thorn bush. Okay? Because it was a sign to you that I have sent you. Okay? And it is fitting. Oh, and it says you will be successful in my mission, and it is fitting that I should save you just like you saw the thorn bush was doing my mission and it was not consumed. So when you go in my mission, you will not be harmed. Okay? So basically what Rashi is saying, that the thorn bush was a prophecy to tell us to tell Moshe. It was a prophecy for Moshe that just like the thorn bush, which was on God's mission to give Moshe information, and the thorn bush was protected, so when you are on my mission, you will be saved. Okay? Now, in Kings 1, chapter 19, It's talking from chapter 18 and 19. It's talking about when Eliyahu was on, that's Elijah, was on Mount Carmel, and all the priests of the Baal were in front of him, and King Ahab was there, and all the Jews were there, and his worst enemies were there. And he did the sacrifice, and not only that, afterwards he had all the priests of the Baal killed. He had the Jews kill all the priests of the Baal, and they wiped them all out. And he stood in front of his worst enemies, and he wasn't afraid. Then it says in chapter 19, verse 2, that Jezebel, that was the wife of Ahab, sent a message to Eliyahu saying, so should God, in other words, she makes an oath and says that this time tomorrow I will take your life full instead of their life, a life for life. Alright, Eliyahu saw the problem. He saw that his life was in danger, and he got up and he ran for his life. Okay, and then he went to Beersheba. Okay, but basically he ran for his life. What is the difference between Eliyahu before the threat of Jezebel, where he stood up in front of his worst enemies, and then after the threat of Jezebel, where he's afraid for his life and he has to run away? What's the difference? In other words, when he was on God's mission, then God would protect them, exactly like the thorn bush. Whenever God gives you a prophecy and sends you on a mission, so then your God will protect you and you have nothing to worry about. You have to make decisions totally in trust of God. But as soon as the mission is over, even the prophet has to act like any other person. If his life is in danger, he must run away. Okay? So you see that the God protects you. You can be guaranteed of God's protection 100% if you are on a mission of God. Then that is the metaphor of the thorn bush. As soon as the mission is over, then you must deal with life like any other person. Okay? Now we go back to Exodus. Again, it's Exodus 3, verse 16. Okay? And God is talking to Moshe and giving him his mission, what his mission is. And one of the things he tells him in verse 16, he says, go and gather the Ziknei Israel. What is Ziknei? Ziknei has two possible interpretations. Either it's old people or the elders. So Rashi explains that it has to be the elders. He says, and if you were to argue and say that it refers to old people in general, that maybe God just wanted to gather the old people, right? Says, how would it be possible for Moses to gather all the elderly of 600,000 people? Impossible. How could Moses do that? Okay. Now, just 2 minutes ago, God said, that we read before, and you will be successful on your mission. I'll protect you. You will not be armed, and you will be successful. Okay? Now, suddenly, Moshe, that God wanted the old people, Moses couldn't do it, so it's impossible. Why God can't get all the old people to come together? He's about to bring 10 plagues, all against the laws of nature. He's about to split the sea. When it came to the ark, he had the animals come to the ark. You understand? I mean, God can't do this. Why is it? Why is Rashi saying it has to be elders? Because if it wasn't the elders, then Moshe couldn't gather them. It would be impossible for Moshe to do that. God just told them that you will be successful, and if God wants the old people, Moshe would get the old people. The answer is that even when you're on a mission of God, you must take responsibility. Even though God guarantees success, you know you won't be successful. You cannot sit back and wait for God to do it. You must do everything in your power to do it in a normal, regular way. And if it doesn't work, then God will help you. It's like a miracle. Then God has to intervene. But however, insofar as what you could do, you must be able to do it on your own. Whatever can be done, you must do. And then beyond that, you rely on God. And since Rashi holds that this is an area that Moshe was able to do on his own, and since he was able to and obligated to do on his own, so therefore it had to be something that's possible for him to do. It would have been impossible to gather all the old people from all over the country, but it would be possible to gather the elders. So we see from here that even during a mission of God, you must take responsibility. You cannot sit back and say, God said he guaranteed success, so now I can sit back. You can't sit back. Even a prophet on a mission of God must deal with the practicality of his mission. In other words, the difference between Elijah's situation and Moshe's situation was Elijah, the mission was over, and therefore he must operate as a regular human being. He doesn't have God's protection. It's not equal to the burning bush. In Moshe's situation, it's in the mission, in doing God's mission. God's mission is happening. He still has to take responsibility to do whatever he can. That's the difference between Elijah, the situation of Elijah, and the situation of Moshe. Again, if Elijah was still on his mission and Jezebel put out a contract on his life, it would be wrong of him to run. That would be the wrong thing, because God guarantees his safety, and he must do that which is on his mission. And therefore, he could stand up against 450 of the priests of Baal, his worst enemy, and Ahab was there, and he wasn't afraid, because he was on the mission of God. And therefore, he doesn't have to be afraid of a whole army. It could be an army of 100,000 people, and him by himself. There would be no fear, because he is like the burning bush. He cannot be harmed. Just like the burning bush cannot be harmed, he cannot be harmed, as long as you're on a mission of God. Once that mission is over, then you have to make decisions like a regular person. But by Moshe's case, he's on the mission. He's still on the mission, and here it's not a problem of danger. It's only being successful. And yet he has to work it out, unless God tells him that, no, I will work it out for you, because I want the old people and I don't mean the elders. But if God doesn't say that, then he has to assume that he has to take responsibility for it. In other words, Eliyahu has to know where his mission begins and ends. I mean, what his mission is, I just assume to kill out the 450 people of the Baal and to give the Jews show them the other possibility, so that they could see the choice between the idols and God. They saw God's power, so they could choose from God. In fact, when he told them to kill out the priests of the Baal, they listened to him. So you see, they took that choice. Okay? So that his mission was over. Now it's up to the Jews to maintain their choice if they want to, or to go back to the Baal. That's their choice. You see?
But he gave them information to be able to make a decision. Now his mission is over. That's it. If his life was in danger during the mission, and he would leave, he would be violating God's trust. He'd be violating God's trust, and that would be wrong. Now, we come back to the story of Yaakov, that's Jacob, when he's meeting Esav. Esav had 400 people with him, 400 warriors. He was coming out. He was afraid of his brother. So it says he sent a peace treaty. It doesn't say peace treaty. It said he sent him a present. He sent him all different types of animals and slaves. And then the verse says, Yaakov was very afraid, and he divided the nation that was with him in half. And he said, if Asa comes to one camp then and slaughters them, then the other will be able to escape. Okay? So, he was preparing for war. And then in verse 10 it says, that's, by the way, chapter 32, from verse Aleph is the story. And in verse 10, it says, and Yaakov said to the God of my father Abraham and the God of my father Isaac, and he prays to him. And he prays to God. So Rashi says he prepared himself. This is verse 9, and it, in the, where the verse says, then the remaining camp shall be a refuge, shall be there for escape. So he says, Jacob prepared himself for three things. One is for paying a tribute or a present. Two is for prayer. And three is for war. Now you'll notice, Rashi changes the order of the verse. Okay, because the verse says that it was a present, he divided the camp, and then he prayed. Rashi says that he sent the present, he prayed, and then he prepared for war. Now Rashi could interpret the verse, but he doesn't have the right to change the verse. Okay, can't change the facts. And the question is, why is Rashi changing the order? So the answer is that the prayer, according to Rashi, Rashi must have held that the prayer went something like this. That I would prefer, God, if the presents were enough, that I don't have to go to war. But if for some reason you don't accept that prayer, for some reason, either I don't deserve it, or for whatever reason God has in mind, then please help me be successful for war. Okay? So therefore, you see that Yaakov, he prepared himself totally within the normal process of dealing in everyday life. He had a very good plan. He had a strategy and a plan. And then he prays to God that the plan should work. And he tells God which way he would prefer, since there's two possible conclusions here. He prefers if it works out one way and not the other, but if God doesn't want, he prays to God that it should work out the other. Okay? So now the question is, then wherein lies your responsibility to prepare, and wherein lies God's responsibility to help you? The answer is that all the plans that you could make, they're outside factors which is beyond your ability to deal with, that you can't be aware of. In war, many things could happen. You say, people's emotions, many different things. You're dealing with Esav. How is he going to take to the present? He's still angry with Yaakov. Will the present appease him? You understand? All these things he doesn't know. So you have to do everything that's within your hands, and after that, you must rely on God. That's where prayer comes in. You must do... Results is not in your hands. In other words, the preparation and doing everything that is necessary to bring about the result That is your responsibility. But however, the results, since that's not in your hands, there are other factors here, so that is not your responsibility. That is God's responsibility. Since it's God's responsibility, we know prayer works, so you have to have tefillah, you have to have prayer and turn to God to bring this about. The question is, what if a person prepares all these things and it doesn't work out? The worst possible scenario. I mean, there's war, and Yaakov loses the war, and he has to run away. God didn't listen to any of his prayers. How should he relate to God? What is his relationship now to God? Look, I prayed to God, and God did not help me. I mean, it's wrong. I mean, I did everything I could. I did everything in the physical world. I prepared correctly, and God did not help me. What should my attitude towards God be? To this, we return to Samuel, the second book of Samuel, in chapter 15. Okay, and here we find that Avshalom, King David's son, has rebelled. His rebellion was successful, and he was going to win the war. And King David decides that the best thing for him to do is to run away. And as he leaves the city, he's moving out of the city, and Tzadok, who was the high priest at the time, was with him. And it says, the king said to Tzadok, "Return the ark of God to the city. If I find favor in God's eyes, he will bring me back and let me behold him and his abode." In other words, I'll come back and be able to worship again in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple. "And if he," God says thus, "I desire you not," in other words, I'm not going to bring you back, "then I am prepared. Let him," God, "do with me as he sees fit." In other words, if I do not make it back, and that is God's will, that I should not make it back, then I accept God's will. I have to accept God's will. Okay? In other words, I don't know all the time why God does things. So therefore, I have to assume that whatever God does is for the best. Now, if it looks bad for me, so I cannot say, well, therefore God is wrong. I must accept the premise that whatever God does is right. And God sees everything that is happening. God knows everything that is happening. And so therefore, it's just a matter of him making the decision whether he should help me or not help me. You understand? But however, my relationship to God must be that I must have true knowledge, without a doubt, that there is a God and how God relates to me. You understand? Once I have that fact and something doesn't work out for me in particular, then I must recognize that the idea that God does everything for the best is true, and even though it's not beneficial for me, in my particular case, it must have a benefit, and I must fit into God's will, and therefore I must accept God's will. If you accept God in this way, there are three benefits. One is, it could be God will listen to your prayer. God does hear your prayer, and it could be he'll listen to it. Okay? That's first. Secondly, since your responsibility is only doing the correct action and the preparation for the result, then once you've done everything you could, if you truly have and it's totally affected and permeated your total being, then you'll be able to sleep at night. You don't have to worry about results. The results are out of your hands. It's out of my hands. There's nothing more I could do. So I'll sleep better. You see? The question is that if it's totally in God's hands, then why should I have to pray? Okay, that is the question. We hold
that God listens to prayers. For whatever reason, we hold that God definitely knows. That's one of the 13 basic principles of faith, that God knows everything and God sees everything what's going on. Okay? And we hold that it's through prayer that God answers. You see, all the prophets, Moshe, when in certain situations, prayed to God. All the people, all the prophets turned to God. You see, in our case, Yaakov turned to God. You see that prayer works. That you do see that prayer works. But if God decides not to, without prayer, then it's not going to work. It means that you don't rely on God. Then you're not following the correct process of bringing about the result. Part of bringing about the result is recognizing and accepting and turning to God. Okay? So if I don't pray, so then it's a high probability that the result won't come about. But then let's put it this way, then it's just the chances of nature. Whatever happens, happens. If you're lucky, and a good thing happens. If you're unlucky, then a bad thing happens. You're leaving it in the hands of chance. You're playing Russian roulette with reality. But however, if you turn to God, that raises the chances of having a better conclusion. But that is no guarantee. Let's say you're asking something which God feels that is harmful, if not for you, maybe for the world. I don't know. There's different factors which we're not aware of that God is aware of. Or maybe it's not beneficial to you. Maybe what you think is good is really not good. And God is saying that, no, you should not have it. So the thing is that you must accept that prayer does work, but whether God listens to your prayer, that's dependent on what is the most beneficial in that situation, and God has all the information. We don't. We have to trust in God. So the three benefits of what I see if you turn to God is, one is that's the method for God to answer your request. It's only through prayer. Second, you could sleep better at night. To sleep better at night means that you have total trust in God. I mean, it's permeated your total being, every part of you. The third thing is, in decision making, even without the training of the mind, a person can make very rational and intelligent decisions. What stops them from making decisions is haughtiness. Certain haughtiness or a psychological part of the mind that affects your thinking process. Those downfalls is listening to the History Channel for some battle, and they kept saying all along that most of the times when the stronger army failed is because they relaxed because they felt it's a sure win. And they didn't do everything they could to win the war, you see? So therefore, there's a certain haughtiness, like, I'm going to win, I'm the winner, that's it. I don't have to work. There's a certain haughtiness that makes you make incorrect decisions. And especially if we're talking about a person that thinks through and plans his things, and he relies on himself, totally, that will definitely bring out his haughtiness, okay? So the counteraction to remove that haughtiness would be where you realize, without a doubt, that results are not in your hands. When you recognize results are not in your hands, then you know that you must do everything that is possible in any given situation, and you can't take anything for granted, but there must be an investigation and a search. A plan and a strategy in each and every case. And so therefore, in that way, the plan will be better. Then you have done more of what you are supposed to do, the preparation, because you're doing the best in the preparation. And therefore, when you pray, it's a better chance that God could listen to you, because if you don't take on your responsibility, then God will not listen to your prayer. There's a Medrash which says that Moshe was down by the sea, and he says, God, well, if we go into the water, we're going to drown. And God says, now is not the time to pray. Now is the time to act.
somebody jumped into the water up into his nose, and he says, God, one more step and I drown, and that's when the water split. So you see, until you do everything that is possible that you can do up to the last, till there's nothing, absolutely nothing more you could do, that's when prayer works. That's when tefillah works. You see? Doesn't work, then you have to accept God's goodness. So somehow it might not be good for you in particular, but somehow it is good that God sees that this is the right thing to do in this situation. The question is, how do I know when I've worked everything through that I covered all the preparation that is necessary to bring out the result? Insofar as that is concerned, each person is different. God cannot expect me to have the same preparation in a certain situation that Moshe had. That's impossible. If he expected me to be like that, then forget it. I'd never be ready. I would never have fulfilled my ability, you see. So each person, according to their ability, must do everything in their ability. And you got to make sure that it's not laziness or haughtiness or mistakes of the emotion, but you worked out, according to your ability, what you could do, you see. Then, when you turn to God, then God can listen to you. But first you must fulfill all the preparation to the best that you can. It should look as if the results are in your hands, but you should simultaneously know that the results are not in your hands. That's a very difficult distinction, especially for the emotions. The mind might see what very clearly, but the emotions, once it did everything, it feels, and especially if it's successful, then the emotions are going to say, look what I accomplished, you see. And the truth is, no, there could have been some outside factor that there was something you didn't think about that could have changed everything. So you see that it's not in your hands. You have to see clearly that it's not in your hands, but really in the hands of God. But you must do everything that's in your power. And the question is, when looking inside yourself, how could you know what's the best that you can do? There's a problem in every area of what my abilities are. And when you start investigating this area, you make certain mistakes about yourself. You could either overestimate yourself or underestimate yourself. I've seen both, and especially students. You see students, some of them overestimate themselves and they try to do things that they can't do. Other students underestimate themselves, so they give up hope before they're ready, you know what I mean? Yes, that's a certain development. Through the study of Musar, that you start understanding your abilities, and as you develop, you get it more and more. That's the only thing you could do. I mean, you can't do more than that. But still, whenever you've done anything, whatever stage you're at, you must do everything that what you think is right. In other words, what you think is right today is one thing, and you have done everything. But then in 5 years from now, you'll realize that you could have done more, or what you were doing was stupid. You did it irrationally. So then then you will see that it's a different thing. But it's a part of the development that you start changing. What you see, what you can do, changes. What your abilities are keep changing. In other words, yes, that's correct. Sometimes the plan is not to do anything. That's the best in a certain situation, not to do something. It could also be true. In other words, going back to just dwell on your failures, that is not a healthy thing. But however, to going back to analyze your failures, so to define what the failure is so that you won't make the mistake in the future, that's a very healthy thing. The difference is the way you look at the past. If you just dwell on the past like it bothers you and just you have to roll it around your mind again and again, that's not helpful. But if you go through the past and see, well, how did I make a mistake and how could I correct that mistake in the future and how could I better myself, then you should go back to the past. Even though it might be painful to face these failures, it's important to go back. Where chapter, the Mishlei Proverbs, where chapter 12, verse 5, and it says, the thoughts of the righteous are justice, and the strategy of the wicked is trickery. Once again, chapter 12, verse 5, says, the thoughts of the righteous are justice, and the strategy of the wicked is dealing with the tzaddik in Russia, not with the regular human being, okay? Regular human being might have evil thoughts, but however, they're not going to carry it out. It doesn't mean in reality. I mean, they might have the desire, but they will never carry it out in reality. We're not talking about the thoughts that a normal person has about harming person or doing damage to another person. We're not doing fooling people. We're not talking about that. We're talking about where it's the thoughts are in reality, where that's what they're going to carry out. And both the wicked and the righteous have developed to a point where there's a change in their personality. Most people, there is no change in their personality from the time they're teenagers till adulthood and onward. In other words, the only thing is there's different situations, but they operate by certain patterns throughout their life. The tzaddik and the rasha make changes in their patterns. One is going towards the world of ideas, and where it comes second nature, that naturally he thinks about justice and righteousness. And it's a natural thing. When there's a problem, we naturally... It's a natural thing to be able to think in terms of justice and righteousness. While the evil person, his nature becomes that he's always working out how to harm somebody, either for practical reasons, for vengeance, or because he doesn't like the way the guy looks. You understand? Whatever the emotion is, it is a real harm that he's thinking. It's not just a daydream. But by the, it's a second nature that way, that becomes part of his personality. Tzaddik, on the other hand, through his study of Torah, it becomes second nature where he thinks in terms of justice. But we're not talking about the normal mediocrity for a person that does not make a decision to move either way, but just to live by his personality. Yeah. If he lives that way, if he thinks that way, then the next verse, verse 6, says that the words of the wicked, when they discuss things, is erev dam, is to ambush for blood. In other words, the wicked person, I mean, whatever he wants to do, he carries out. He's not afraid of killing or murder, whatever it takes to get what he wants. So his counsel, his words, when he brings it out, the discussion, is willing to kill. In other words, a regular person might think of killing somebody, but they would never carry it out. Okay? And the mouth of the righteous is yatzilem, to save them. In other words, because he's involved in justice, he always thinks about saving the person that is being destroyed by the wicked. He thinks in terms of saving them and trying to help the person that is downtrodden. It's a natural thing, and he tries to work it out, and he puts some time in it. And verse 7 says, the Russia is turned over, turned upside down, or destroyed, and he does not exist. It's no more. And the house of the righteous will stand. In other words, many times, in the end, in other words, there's two ways that the Russia could be destroyed. Even though he is very, very powerful, well, really, there are three ways that the Russia could be destroyed. One way is through the laws of nature, because he becomes very haughty in his successes, and his haughtiness makes terrible decisions. Two is God intervenes. And three is, which makes the most sense, which follows the subject of our verse, is that the righteous, through wisdom of Chachma, even though the
the wicked are very powerful. He's able to undermine them and bring them down. Okay? And the house of the righteous stands, even though they are not powerful, physically powerful, looks like they would fall apart and very easily destroyed. The question is that true only in a Torah society? The answer is, it is true where there is a righteous person. In any society where there is a righteous person, that righteous person will actually think that way and be involved in the in trying to help the underdog and to undermine the wicked. The question is, will the righteous be able to win over the wicked person? No, not always. Sometimes the situation is such that he can't work it out. I mean, you see many times, like Rabbi Akiva was... the question is, it seems to be out of the a Torah society that it's a random situation where the righteous will win over the wicked. But it's not a inherent in the like inherent principle that it should be so. That is the question. The answer is that for the righteous to be successful, there's certain times where it is dependent totally on himself. If the success is dependent totally on himself, then he will be successful. But where it's dependent on other people, then it depends on the other people. Like, for instance, Moshe killed the Egyptian, and you see that he really wanted to help the Jews. But then the next day, there was the story of the two Jews that were fighting, and when Moshe tried to straighten them out, they both came up against Moshe. So you see, there's certain, Moshe's interpretation was, there's certain people that don't want to be helped. You can't help a person that doesn't want to be helped. Well, there's certain situations where it's dependent on people that can't stand up, that you tell them, you know, stand up. You see? So therefore, inherently, the tzaddik will win over the wicked, but however, certain times there's circumstances where the circumstances are such that he cannot be successful. I'd like to show a little application to the study of Proverbs, okay? I was watching the History Channel, and I was watching the... they had the barbarians. They had the Vikings, the Goths, the Mongols, and the Huns. Okay. It was four hours, okay? From what I noticed from these stories... there were three kind of mistakes that the leaders made that made them fail. I mean, I'm not saying there aren't more mistakes that tyrants could make. It's what I noticed, okay? One is there was haughtiness. By haughtiness, I mean when a person is first starting out and they are considered the losers. So they have to check out and work out every single angle and think out every single plan and strategy to work it out so that they can be successful. There's a certain haughtiness at a certain point that I am successful and therefore I don't have to put in the same amount of watching and protection of myself. That's it. I'm a winner. You see? That attitude brought down, that was one aspect of the attitude that brought down one or two of the leaders, okay? The next thing is that driven. You're driven by a certain emotion of accomplishment and success, and they were driven beyond their ability, beyond their resources to control all the land that they own. So therefore, sometimes when you're driven, I mean, in a particular person, sometimes you're driven and you do things beyond your abilities where you can't operate anymore. But the thing is that
is that over here they went beyond their resources to be able to control the lands, and that's what we condemn. Third one that I noticed was enemies. They made enemies. And sometimes the enemies would join together, or sometimes there might have been one person that had leadership qualities. You made him an enemy, then he became a leader and he turned against you. So therefore, making enemies, you never know when you're going to make an enemy that's going to turn against you and be successful. These were the things that I noticed. Also, there was one other thing. I don't know if I got it from the program, but I was thinking about it, that the reason why they're called barbarians is these leaders were very... they say that Genghis Khan, the head of the Mongols, that his strategy of war is being used and worked on today. They study his strategy of war, train yourself in war. So these were not foolish people. These were not stupid. Why do you call them barbarians? It's because of bigotry. In other words, every nation thinks they're the greatest and they look down on others. In other words, during the Second World War, the Japanese thought that they were very special and they were greater. Their race was better than any other race and special. While the Americans, the opposite, they looked down and they made fun of the Japanese. And they looked down on them. That type of bigotry, that type of looking down is the same as the first reason, as haughtiness, that... that you look down on a person so you're not protected, but you don't feel they can harm you back because you're above them and you're the successful person and they're the losers. There are two opposites. There's the tzaddik or the righteous person and the wicked person. Okay? Right. Now, the tzaddik and the rasha, the wicked person, make a decision to go out of this society. They do exactly what they desire to do. The tzaddik desires to live the life of wisdom and chachma, just, and as a result of that, the life of justice and kindness, while the wicked person desires to satisfy one of his emotions. In this part of history that we're talking about, it's being a ruler, control of the different lands and different peoples. It's the desire to control. There are others. There are people that have spent their lives, the life of pleasure, and they've chosen that life, and they've made that decision, and they've given up everything else, and they put all their energy into that quality. They have made... the question is, what do we mean by the life of pleasure, like Elvis Presley? I mean, it was all his life. All he looked for was pleasure, and he searched for pleasure. However, most people, the rest of the world, does not make decisions. They become followers. Certain people become followers of the evil person. Certain people are followers of the righteous person. Certain people just follow society, the life of pleasure, or whatever it is. They always follow. They're part of society, and their lifestyle is totally dependent on the society. Okay? They never pull out, can make decisions outside of society. Okay? Their decisions are always within the realm of society. Okay? When the Germans were under Nazi rule, they didn't complain. I mean, there was no real sense of justice. But afterwards, there was a sense of guilt. They had national guilt where they, I mean, it was good for the Jews afterwards because that guilt, they gave to the Jews different things that were... Now, beneficial for the Jews at that time. But it was a sense of guilt. It wasn't that they thought out this is the just thing to do. So the thing is that
your personality is simply, or how you make decisions is simply based on society, and you cannot pull out of the of that way of making decisions. You have the emotions of the society, you have the emotions of your family, you have these emotions, and you just go along with the crowd. The only good thing is if you follow a tzaddik, then he will introduce to you the causes. Like, for instance, King Solomon, he introduces the basic drives of the human being, like we're just talking about now, the different emotions that affect you and how they harm you, so you can investigate your premises of your own life and what guides you. And once you undo those premises, then you can be an independent thinker, you see? But before you undo the premises, you're guided by these premises. Okay, the premises of whatever society, you happen to be in, or whatever society you join, that is becomes the your conscience. It becomes who guides you and what guides you. Okay, so if you join a society of guilt, so then you'll have guilt about certain people and feel bad for them, even though it might not be just to help them. In other cases, you'll be other people will follow evil people, and they'll won't have any conscience. They'll just follow the evil person. They'll give up their conscience to the evil person. Okay, so that's how the different people. In other words, there is a question. Many times when you study Mishlei, you find that these things don't apply to me. You know, like it sounds. First of all, some of them don't. Some of them do. Not every quality. But it might be that that Mishlei deals with the Rasha, the person that made the decision, the independent person that makes a decision to live his life according to his own emotions. While mediocrity, the regular person, the reason why I call them mediocrity is because they don't make a decision. They don't really make a decision. They're just guided by certain premises that is accepted by their society. The question is, somebody asked, what is the subject? Or what question are we answering with this discussion? The answer is that many times when we study Proverbs, people don't seem to notice how it affects them, and they don't recognize the importance of it. In other words, many times when people give a psychological reason for failure, it's just that particular case, but it's not. They don't look at it as a universal in life, that every human being has to investigate his premises. You see, what I'm trying to show you from history, from this particular history, how the book of Mishlei will help protect you if you think about these problems, and if you're ever in such a situation, you will not allow the emotion to take over. But it's not a matter of remembering this or that discussion, this or that particular discussion. It's a matter of training yourself to think in a particular way, in a certain way. You see? So therefore, that's the reason for the discussion. In other words, to show you that how it affects you. In other words, I'm showing you from society, from how people made decisions in history, how these emotions affect the person, so that you realize these things will affect you. And it will affect the way you make decisions in life. And therefore, you must investigate and recognize how, you must think a certain way. First, to recognize that you are guided by it, and then to train your mind to think in a totally according to the world of ideas, so that you recognize it in your own decision making. Okay, the question was posed that let's say a person is raised like a Muslim, and he's trained from youth on to be a suicide bomber. He doesn't know anything else.
okay, is that inherent? Is that now that is inherent in his existence, or is there a part of him, or it's not inherent, and there is a part of him that he could still see the truth? In other words, is the way you train? In other words, is justice and truth an inherent part of the person that he can counteract the emotions, or are the emotions the basic foundation, and there is no, and so if they're trained that way, there's no way out? The original question is, his ideas of justice, is it inherent in the human being or not? Okay? Now, Max asked the question, what about we have new knowledge today, which we never had before, and so therefore we should have new ideas? The answer is, insofar as justice or kindness, life has not changed. You might get new information about physics. The answer is that it is inherent in the human being, and I'll try to show you why. You see, what is justice? Justice is equality. That you and I are the same, and I don't have the right to hurt you unless you are harming society. Then I have the right not to hurt you, but to protect society. But there is such a thing as equality. Okay? Now, once I know the idea of equality, why should, in other words, I know 2 plus 3 is equal to 5. I know oranges are equal to oranges. I know oranges are equal to apples, that they're both fruit. So I know there's such a thing as equality. Why don't I extend that idea of equality to the human being? If I don't, that means there is some emotion which is stopping me from seeing this idea, which I see in every other area of equality. So therefore, inherently, there is an idea of justice. It's a matter of extending it to, in other words, the universal is equality, and I have to extend it to human beings, and in that case we call equality justice. You see? So therefore that shows that we do have that equality. Right? When I answered this, the person that asked me the question said, what about idolatry? Inherently, can a person see that idolatry is wrong? In other words, is there something inherent in a person that could counteract idolatry, even though he's raised in an idolatrous society? We see the fact that it can be done because Abraham was raised in an idolatrous, total idolatrous society, and he pulled out. So we see it can be done. We want to understand how it works. The answer is there are two ways of perceiving the physical world. Either I look at the physical world and I see the truth, or I see the physical world in my own framework. I only see it based on my emotions, what I want to see. Okay? For instance, a person that thinks he can fly, that's psychotic, because he has no sense of reality. But most people realize they can't jump off a roof or they could hurt themselves. Okay? Now, that sense of reality is always attached to the five senses. So you have a sense of reality in your five senses. The only place where you lose that sense of reality and your personal framework takes over and changes things is in the world of ideas. That's where people fool themselves. So the thing is that you can recognize reality if you could extend the sense of reality from your five senses to the world of thought and ideas. Then once you do that, then that could pull you out of, you have that ability, then you could pull out of a society, even of idolatry, even if you were raised that way, you have the ability because you do have a sense of reality, so you can pull out of it. Right. And the question is, what is addiction? Okay, that's the question.
or the question is how to recognize when you have an addiction, okay? The answer is that when a person, when there's something he knows that is harmful to himself, and he knows he can really hurt himself, and he cannot stop himself from doing that act, that becomes an addiction. In other words, sometimes there's an act which is harmful. Sometimes it's not the quality of the act, but it is the quantity of the act, or the situation where you're going to do the act, which is harmful. Okay? So therefore, if you cannot control yourself from doing an act, so then that it becomes a harm to you. That is an addiction. Now the question is asked, what about can a person be addicted to Torah? The answer is yes, and he'll push himself more than he can tolerate, either physically, he'll keep pushing himself beyond his need for food and sleep, or he'll push himself beyond his ability, his psychological ability, and it'll affect his mind because he'll go beyond which he can do. So yes, learning can be an addiction and harmful if you go beyond your ability to either your physical ability or you go beyond your psychological ability to be able to learn. The question is, let's say the person has an ability to learn 18 hours a day with no harm, and he forces himself to learn that 18 hours, and he doesn't allow any interruptions in this, and he just works on his learning. The answer is that I don't define that as an addiction. An addiction is only where you are forced to do something which is harmful to yourself, and you cannot control yourself. That's how I define an addiction. So therefore, a person learning 18 hours a day where there's no harm to himself, I say there's no addiction. In other words, the question is, let's say somebody has a need to learn for an hour a day, and if he doesn't learn that hour a day, he gets depressed and he feels bad. He must have that hour of learning. But there is absolutely no harm to him. In other words, I am defining the term addiction as that which is harmful to the person. So therefore, if you're drawn, I'd use a different term, if you're drawn, if you hold addiction is where I'm forced to do something, whether it's harmful or not, then yes, then that would be an addiction. But I'm using the term addiction only as a harmful thing. In other words, if you are forced to do something that is good for you, I don't consider, or even if you're driven by an inner drive to do something, I don't think that is harmful. If you use the term addiction, it's only addiction as a metaphor. But a real addiction is where it's harmful to the self. In other words, we're not talking about enjoyments. Let's say I enjoy playing ball. It's fine, play ball, but if you play 12 hours a day where you can't take care of your responsibilities and you're just driven to it, so then it's not. Then the quantity makes it an addiction. But playing ball is not an addiction. As long as it's within the right amount and it doesn't harm you, it doesn't take you away from the other responsibilities. In other words, let's say, for instance, during midterm week, a person could force himself and be driven because of his grades to work 12 and 14 hours a day, but then after midterms, he recoups. That is not harm. That is not a harm. And there are certain people that can't last even for a week 14 hours a day. But if those that can, that is not a harm because they know they're forced to do it for a short amount of time, but then they stop. Okay? And they recoup. So therefore, if you push yourself for a couple of days, what your abilities are, so then you recoup. That's not an addiction. Okay, the question is that Michael Jordan gave up all his schooling. We're assuming that. Let's assume he did that. Okay? And then he spent all his time to get in the NBA, and he got the NBA, and he made millions of dollars. Okay? The question is that an addiction, and is that wrong? The answer is like this. if he without thought he did that, even though he was successful and he didn't pay the consequences, that's an addiction, but it was the wrong evaluation. But if he thought it through and he says, look, I mean, it's easy to become a lawyer than to get in the NBA. The very small percentage of our populace that gets into the NBA. Therefore, you have to have unbelievable special qualities to be able to make it. If you are totally honest and you evaluate that you can, you make an evaluation that you can make it, and the probability of you making it is, let's say, 90 or 95%, it might be worth it to do it. You understand? Then it's an evaluation that I would not call an addiction. If he did it without thought, even though he didn't pay the consequences, I say it was stupid. That's an addiction. Because he didn't make any evaluation. It was just lucky. He happened to have the qualities, so he made it. But I'm sure there are many other people that thought like that, and they failed. We don't know these stories. You see? So therefore, it has to be an evaluation, an honest evaluation of what it takes to be an NBA player, and that whether you even have those abilities, that has to be shown pretty early in your career, that you should see that it's happening, whether you could rely on it, or you should have a secondary, area of to fall back on. But if you fail and you don't have what to fall back on, you could be in real trouble. You'll pay terrible consequences. Right, the question is how do you deal with insecurities, okay? I'm only taking the first step, okay, to deal with it. That doesn't work, then you have to go further. The first step is to evaluate whether that insecurity is in line with reality or not in line with reality. Let's say, for instance, there are people that take tests and they're always successful. Yet every time they have to take a test, they always feel, I'm going to fail. There's certain people that fail on tests. Their insecurity about tests is based on reality. That's not wrong. I mean, the emotion is in line with the reality. But if you feel insecure about something you've done for many years and that you do well at, and then you feel insecure, then that is that would be an insecurity. So I'm saying the first step is to evaluate whether the insecurity is in line with reality. Now, if you think it through many times and then you still can't get rid of the insecurity by recognizing that it's not in line with reality, then you have to investigate the psychological cause of your insecurities. And I'd like to discuss the difference between the Chacham and the Tzaddik, the wise man and the righteous. Okay? Now, insofar as halacha is concerned, tzaddik or a righteous person is a person that keeps the halacha. But insofar as hashkafa or philosophy is concerned, there's a difference in the nature of the person. But insofar as hashkafa or philosophy is concerned, the difference between the Chacham and the Tzaddik is in the personality, okay? And I'd like to work with the two examples to try to show clearly the difference between the Chacham and the Tzaddik, okay? The first example is an area that we've done, the God's justice. In other words, there's a question when bad things happen to righteous people. So the question is, where's God's justice? We're not planning on answering that question today, but I'd like to discuss the difference between the Chacham and the Tzaddik, how they would relate to that problem and the difference between them. Okay? Right. Now the question of first let me explain the difference between the Chacham, and the clarification will come through two examples that we have. The Chacham, it has
In other words, logically, the Chacham and the Tzaddik both think correctly, and they could take logical answers. But however, logic affects your personality, and insofar as their personality is concerned, there is a difference in their personality. A Chacham is a beginner to the world of philosophy or Hashkafa, okay? And therefore, he basically has, like every human being, he bases his life. When anybody starts out in life, they base their life on pleasure principle, pleasure or pain. Okay, in other words, they try to get the most amount of pleasure with the least amount of pain. What the Chacham does is he tries to work that out rationally. Okay. In other words, rationally, that he should be able to get the most amount of pleasure for the least amount of pain, and therefore he will be more successful than the ordinary or regular person. The tzaddik, everybody must start as a chacham. The tzaddik, as he starts working out his life through chachma, at a certain point he's drawn to the wisdom. He's drawn to the wisdom itself. The best explanation is to show two types of psychological relationships. There are certain people that relate to others, and they like the person and draw to the person, but only insofar as what they could get out of it. Best example is a business person and a politician. You have a friend that's in your business world. I mean, you're friendly only insofar as you need each other for business. And the same thing for politics. You're only friends insofar as you need them for politics. However, there is a friendship or a love that you're drawn to the other person, that you want to help the other person. You're drawn to the other person, not so much what you can get out of the person, but you're drawn to the person themselves. The same thing philosophically in your development. Emotionally, when you start out, your first investigation, you started out is, what can wisdom do for me? When you think that way, then you are a chacham. But however, but after you're drawn to the wisdom, then wisdom becomes objectively an object of love, that you're drawn to it, and you do that which is correct because it fits in with your system, fits in with your ideas. It's not how it benefits you. You don't think in those terms. Okay? That's the difference between the Chacham and the tzaddik. Now for the application. Let's say when we say that that God's justice, it's a question of God's justice. So we say that that sometimes it's not God's justice because it's in the laws of nature. God is relating to you personally, so then it's because you did something, punishing you, so it's because you did something evil. But in the laws of nature, things could happen to you that it's God's system, but it's not because of you, it's like part of the system. In other words, a person could get sick. It's not because God wanted to punish you. It's just that's the way the system works. People do get sick, and there's a certain percentage of people that they get certain diseases, and so they get that disease. Okay? So therefore, you can't say it's God's fault. And where's God's justice? That God isn't relating to the righteous person, because God doesn't always relate to the righteous person. Now, the answer is logical, and anybody could understand it. But emotionally, the answer, if I hold by pleasure-pain principle, the answer is not totally satisfying, because the thing is that I only look at it in terms of pain and the avoidance of pain. That is certain pain I can't avoid. You see, I have to accept certain reality that I am not, that I'm totally like, in other words, there's a lack of protection. I feel a certain, in other words, when you first come across this idea, in other words, if you're a religious person and you feel you are protected constantly by God, so the Chacham is going to feel, at this point, not protected, you see? He's going to have a conflict with dealing with this idea. He can learn to relate to it and deal with it, but because he lives by pleasure-pain, and pleasure-pain means that I feel protected, that there's a certain amount of... this is taking away, to a certain extent, it's taking away a certain comfort. You see? It's removing comfort, and he's looking for comfort. You see? While the tzaddik who only looks at the system, he says, well, let me see, does it fit into the system? Is the system working? The particular of he himself, let's say, for instance, the great sages that were being taught, they were going to be tortured the next day by the Romans, so they asked the question, why do I deserve this? And they, each one worked out a reason why they deserve it. You see? That was satisfying. Of course, as long as they know the system. Rabbi Akiva, he didn't find anything why he should be punished. And yet he was very happy. You see why? Because he recognized the system. You see, he just related to the system. And according to the system, the punishment is that when God punishes Klal Yisrael, the nation of Israel, so then it doesn't distinguish between the different individuals of the nation. And so he recognized that he was being punished as part of Israel. That's part of the system. That's satisfying because he understood the system. It was also satisfying because he recognized that his emotions were in line with God's system. In other words, your knowledge could be in line with God's system, but under extraordinary circumstances, if your emotions are not, then you could break down. But he was happy that he didn't break down, that his emotions were in line with God's system, and he accepted God's justice as is, that even though he didn't do anything wrong, but according to God's system, he was to die, so therefore he accepted God's will. You see? But it fit in with his system. That was enough for Rabbi Akiva, for the tzaddik. You see? But for the chacham at that situation, logically he could accept the answer, but emotionally he could be in real trouble. Could break down in that situation. I remember the question is to expand on the chacham, why he might break down. Okay, many times when you have to perform or do something, so you practice it very, very well, because under pressure you sometimes can't think. The emotions take over. You just can't think in that situation. So you're going to, if something goes wrong in a tense situation, how you're going to react is you don't have time to think. You're going to react based on your feelings, how you feel. You see? Now the question is, where is your feelings? If your feelings are still the old pleasure-pain principle, I mean, and you, in other words, where the self is very important, then this torture or whatever is happening to you at that time could affect you the way it would affect any human being. You see, in that situation, you become weakened, because even though you live your life rationally, but the emotions take over in that situation. The tzaddik, where his emotions are in line, where he's drawn emotionally to the world of ideas, the particular isn't important. You see? The particular to the tzaddik is like stars were to Einstein. Stars were to Einstein only a means of understanding the his theories. The tzaddik, when something happens, so it's only a means of understanding his theories. That's all he needs the particular for. But emotionally, psychologically, he's drawn to the world of ideas. So therefore, if something goes wrong, the only thing that's important to him, the only thing important to him emotionally, does this fit into the system as I understand it? If I have a question, then I have to deal with the question. Like, that's his nature. He'll just deal with the question. But the thing is, it's not the particular that's important anymore.